360.
Some of the most interesting theatrical productions staged over the last few years didn't actually have any stage at all, not in the conventional sense. For instance, just here in New York City, last year there was an opera performed among the exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History. One of my favorites was an adaptation of James Joyce's turn-of-the-century story, The Dead, staged in a turn-of-the-century New York townhouse.
Is it snowing again, Mr. Conroy?
Yes, Lily, I'm afraid we're in for a night of it.
The Macbeth Bay Sleep No More is still running after years in an abandoned warehouse.
These are your masks for this evening.
Part of what delights people about these immersive productions is that they break traditions of how plays are staged. The playgoers don't sit still and stare straight ahead. They wander and look around. But where did those traditions around staging that these productions are breaking come from in the first place? Joshua Dax is one of America's premier designers of theatrical spaces. And his firm has worked on performance halls all over the world, from Lincoln Center to Hong Kong and many other places. After reading his article for American Theater Magazine about the history of the stage, how it evolved and how it's still evolving, we asked him in to talk. I don't think I'd ever even thought about how theater stages came to be. Then I read your pieces and have become totally fascinated.
Oh, thank you.
So let's start at the beginning with the Greeks. When Sophocles wrote his play Oedipus Rex 2,400 years ago, what kind of stage was that performed on and how had it come to be?
So there was this idea that somebody had at some point to sort of cross the boundary from storytelling around a campfire to some more structured exercise that had a social purpose. Why do we go to the theater? Why did the Greeks require all citizens to go attend the Feast of Dionysus? It really had something to do with wanting to develop a common set of values. You know, what does it mean to be an Athenian? What do we value as a society? What are our moral responsibilities to each other? And that's what those plays are about. So the purpose in the society was to sort of weld community out of a group of disparate individuals. What did they have at their fingertips in order to help do that? They had some places that already had meaning. You know, there were some early places where performance happened, and they were often big open areas like threshing floors that had some ceremonial purpose.
Threshing floors meaning where they processed the grain they'd harvested and spread it down and stomped on it or beat on it to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that there were temples facing onto the threshing floor, and that nearby, in view of the temple, in view of the statue of the god in the temple, was the threshing floor and ultimately the sacrificial altar.
Which was used presumably for some kind of harvest ritual?
Exactly. So there were these altars and there were these threshing floors and there were these temples and there were hillsides, right? So you could gather the population on a hillside overlooking all of this and take advantage of the fact that those places had meaning already. And as this evolved, the hillside would eventually be turned into a stone amphitheater.
They put seats on.
They put seats in. And a building was built for the actors to go and come from. But ultimately, if you look at the Theater of Dionysus in Athens, the hillside faced the sacrificial altar, and the temple faced the altar.
Right. Of course, the Romans did their bit in creating stages. They built on what the Greeks had done, yeah?
Absolutely. So the Greeks built their amphitheaters on hillsides. Made perfect sense. It was easy. The slope was already there. The Romans were very sophisticated engineers, and, you know, all you have to do is look at a photograph of the ruins of the Colosseum. They didn't need the hillside.
They
made their own hillside anywhere they wanted. So they manufactured these places of performance, made to order.
So fast forward 1,500 years to England. So we have itinerant performers traveling from town to town, city to city in their wagons and using the wagons as their little stage?
Yeah, certainly. It was an easy thing to pull a wagon into a marketplace and get up on the back of it and perform.
How did they sell tickets?
Selling tickets became an important thing. When you're out in the marketplace, you have to pass the hat. But if you can go convince the owner of an inn that he should let you use his courtyard, then it's gated. right? You can sell someone a ticket to come in, and the owner can sell beer. So everybody wins. You can take that model and do it for a number of years and then realize, well, wait a minute, we don't need this guy that owns the inn.
We can start from scratch.
We can build our own thing.
So a courtyard theater, paint a picture of what that is. It's like an inn that has a closed outdoor courtyard and they build a temporary stage?
It was a courtyard ringed by galleries, balconies, a couple of levels, and a flat-floored yard, which was dirt. And in that yard, a platform had been built, usually covered so that it was a bit protected from rain and sun. And that was it. There was a little backstage area called the tiring house where you would put on your attire and off you went.
And were they in the round or were those stages usually built at the side?
The stages projected out into the yard. Some of the yards were square. Some of the yards were polygonal.
But they backed onto the building, the stage itself?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was kind of a repetition of what had happened centuries before in antiquity with the development of theatrical stages in Greece, right?
Well, absolutely true. And what's interesting about both of these things, the evolution of the Greek theater and the evolution of the Elizabethan stage, is that they took models that had been improvised in found spaces and they became refined and sort of codified and institutionalized.
So the Renaissance comes along and we're inching closer to the proscenium theater that we know today. What happened to Renaissance stages?
Well, in the Renaissance, it was a time of great princely wealth and competition for having the latest and greatest stuff. And one way to do something extraordinary was to celebrate the wedding of your son or daughter with a huge party with all kinds of elaborate entertainments. Basically, they were improvised performances in ballrooms or other spaces that were large and available. So after a few decades of improvising these things in spaces that weren't quite suitable, somebody had the idea to sort of adapt an existing space in a palace into what we would recognize as a proscenium theater in Parma, Teatro Farnese. And there's a recognizable stage house with a recognizable proscenium opening.
And by the proscenium opening, we mean, of course, the
big
thing.
Arch, a big arch.
Our big arch, and right. A curtain comes down.
Yep. And a big horseshoe-shaped auditorium, actually, with music and dancing. And this branched off into art forms that we now know as opera and ballet. And it wasn't long before we got to things that we would recognize as an Italian horseshoe-shaped opera house, just like La Scala.
And basically, that becomes the proscenium theater that we see in theaters up and down Broadway today.
That's right.
Almost all of which, by the way, were built in this very brief period from 1910 to 1930. You have worked a lot in the Broadway theater. Do you think this big installed base of primo New York theaters has constrained and maybe calcified the way that theater is conceived and produced and experienced because we're stuck with all these circa 1920 houses?
The Broadway theater is suggestive of a kind of form of play and of musical, and those things these days have to respond to all sorts of commercial pressures that keep casts low
right.
And are known quantities that a producer thinks they're going to be able to make money with. So all those buildings were put up in hopes of making a lot of money, and they have, right? They're all on the smallest possible piece of land that you could fit the most possible seats on. There are few amenities, there's lots of seats, a little stage, and practically no dressing room. And sure, did those lead to certain forms or did they respond to some existing forms? You know, certainly the American Broadway musical was born in those spaces and survives in those spaces.
Right. But in the last few decades, interesting cutting-edge theater makers have moved away from conventional prosceniums and 400 seats to use these all kinds of unorthodox found spaces, right?
A great example in New York these days is the Armory, the Park
right.
Avenue Armory.
Where you've worked.
I've been helping them adapt it for the last decade, and I've done a number of shows there as well.
Was it a 19th century armory where soldiers drilled?
Exactly. This is a building that has a rich history that is palpable from the moment you walk in the door. The idea that this is a military installation, it's a drill hall. When you put a play on or a dance piece or some strange installation, the building itself is a powerful part of the context, and everything in there in some way plays with it.
And in the last, I don't know, 10 years, this big old New York armory has become an important cool cultural venue hosting all kinds of these extravaganzas. Marina Abramović did this performance art piece there. The guy from the band Massive Attack worked with the filmmaker Adam Curtis and put on an extraordinary multimedia show. Kenneth Branagh did a version of Macbeth in this very bloody, muddy staging there. Now, that's been such a success. You and your firm are working with architects, Liz Diller, Rick Scafidio, David Rockwell, on this brand new theatrical space, multi-million dollar space that sounds like the Armory. It's over by the Hudson River. It's called The Shed. Talk about that.
Basically, it's a four-story building that contains many things, including some studio theaters and support spaces. And over this entire four-story building, there is a transparent skin, I'll say, that is built as a structure independent of the building, and it can roll on railroad tracks. So imagine that the walls and the ceiling of this building decide to go for a walk, right? And they leave the building behind and they go cover an adjacent plaza. And it creates a new covered indoor space where an outdoor plaza had been.
It's almost magical realist, like in the movie Howl's Moving Castle. Really an extraordinary technical achievement. We've got a video people can see of the building in motion on our website. So, Joshua, I guess this is stage history repeating itself, as you've explained, yet again, this ad hoc improvised design idea. Oh, an old abandoned armory gets formalized and codified and becomes an institution.
Exactly. And what's fascinating to me is that it's exactly the same trajectory. So the armory is a space that was built for a military purpose that people improvised performances in. And here comes this building, the shed, which is a purpose-built one of those.
Yes, exactly.
And what it tells us is that you can't keep creativity down and that there's a constant oscillation between improvised and designed. If the tools that they have to work with are so formalized that it's just a straitjacket, artists respond to that by saying, we're going to do something completely different and we're going to go off and we're going to improvise something. If that's successful, if that improvisation looks fertile, people will take it and run with it. And that will perhaps eventually develop into a formalized, purpose-built, purposely designed version of that. And somebody's going to get bored with that and move on to something else.
Joshua Dax, this has been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Joshua Dax is principal of Fisher Dax Associates, which is a theater design firm based in New York.